everybody, and welcome to Caffeination 320. Yes, this is Caffeination 320 for this, the 22nd of March 2009. It's going to be a great episode, going to be a great show for you here today. This is the Steeped in History episode here at the Caffeination Podcast. We're going to be talking about a lot of great things in the Philadelphia area that happened the past couple weeks. We're going to be talking about a lot of other tiny little things that have been going around, and some other big ones as well. If you're going to be listening to today's show, you're going to be hearing about any and all of the following topics: zoos, art, social tagging, history, robots, fish, coffee, and beer. Like I said, it's a good little mix of topics and conversations flowing throughout today's show. This is, of course, the Caffeination Podcast. We are steeped in the high octane world of caffeine culture and technology news. This and all of the other episodes are lovingly nestled over at www.caffeinaton.com. That is caffeination.com. Being this is a Caffeination Podcast, we thought it was a good place to kind of keep all our stuff, if you know what I mean. The Caffeination is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. This show, as well as all the other shows in the network, have agreed to create child-safe, family-friendly, and educational content. So you can find out more by heading on over to www.techpodcasts.com. Caffeination is also a proud member of the Blueberry Podcast Network. That's Blubrry. It's a social podcasting site. It's kind of like MySpace for podcasts. Pretty fun to kind of scroll around and check that stuff out over there. If you have any comments, feedback, suggestions, or hate mail about any of the fun little stories or quips or anything that we talk about on today's show, please feel free to fire an email off to caffeination@gmail.com, or just comment on the episode or any of the other articles that you actually think are interesting and are, just wanted to extend the conversation on. That's what we're all about here at the Caffeination. I love extending the conversation beyond this current episode, so if there's anything at all within the episode that you like or you want to discuss more on, please feel free to do so. It's really kind of interesting and kind of fun. I love how a lot of the things that I've been talking about recently, a lot of the different things that have been announced here at the show and other places, have kind of expanded beyond that one specific episode. Like, there's been stories referring from other episodes. There's been, it's just turning into much more of a narrative and much less of an instance-related show. So that's kind of fun to play around with, I gotta tell you. Before we head on too much further in today's show, I did want to talk to you just a little bit about the sponsor for today's show. Business Travel is a profitability killer, so do more and travel less with GoToMeeting, the easiest online meeting service. With just a click, you can launch sales presentations, training sessions, or product demos from a collaborative session right from the comfort of your own desk. GoToMeeting is so easy to set up and use, you'll have your first meeting running in seconds. Plus, hold as many meetings as you want for one flat rate. Free voiceover IP and phone conferencing included. Try GoToMeeting free right now for 30 days. With this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/techpodcasts to get your free trial today. I'd like to thank GoToMeeting for being a continued sponsor here at the Caffeination Podcast. They allow us to do all kinds of crazy and cool, fun things that we do on today's show, on all of our shows. So we have a great lineup for you of all the different little things. One of the reasons that this is actually the Steeped in History edition here is we actually made a small sojourn to the Philadelphia Zoo, the Zoological Gardens here in Philadelphia, and they just recently turned 150 years old. If you're in the United States, the Philly Zoo is the absolute oldest zoo in the nation, so it's kind of fun to visit. My family have been members off and on for, I'd say, probably around 60% of my life. It's really a great value. Not only are your dollars helping conservation, are they actually going to different breeding programs and other different things that are, trying to keep the zoo solvent, but and you can actually see the educational aspects of different attractions and everything kind of take shape. So, some of my earliest memories are of certain different things at the zoo, like Massa the gorilla, who happens to to be the oldest or longest lived gorilla in captivity. He lived to the ripe old age of 54 years old. Now, I was unaware as to why or how he was able to do that and why other zoos didn't have a success earlier on. And it turns out that the Philadelphia Zoo was one of the pioneers in actual, in feeding gorillas and feeding the animals that actually live there a different kind of diet to kind of increase their longevity and kind of, you know, better take care of their nutritional needs. And, you know, just, it's really cool. All the tiny little fun facts that we've been learning, you know, you know, wandering around. The first date I ever went on with my wife was actually to the zoo, way back in 1999. So, it's always kind of fun when things come full circle. Now that we can take our son there, it's just really, really fun. He absolutely loves the zoo. And, yeah, there's just so much to do. So, we were there celebrating their 150th anniversary, their sesquicentennial, there you go. So they actually had, people in period costume from way back in 1859 when the charter was actually signed for the Zoological Gardens here in Philadelphia. So it was fun to wander around and do that. They actually had a cape competition, a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm going to be passing information along about the celebration and a couple other things. As soon as I get a chance to write an article on it, I have to pull the stuff off the camera first. So just thought it was pretty fun and kind of cool. But beyond that, there's a whole bunch of great content for today's show. We're going to dive right on into it for you. All right, up first is an interesting little article from a website called the Caffeination Podcast. It's over at caffeination.com, where they're talking a little bit about the Philadelphia Art Museum. Now, I've been there a couple times. And I really kind of enjoy it. One of the funny things about the Philadelphia Art Museum is that currently, right now, they have pay-as-you-like on Sundays. It used to be free to get into before noon. And this is like a world-class art museum. So this is kind of unheard of. And they have rather interesting policies regarding you know, cameras and things like that. As long as you have the flash off, you're allowed to take pictures, which I felt kind of liberating. It was like, wow, you know, that's really kind of cool. And I know that's the case in a lot of other museums that are out there. But my wife and I took our son to the art museum with our friends Marion and Dave a little while ago, like I think 3 weeks ago at this point, but. That's not the point here. The thing is that when we took him, he was so loud and so full of energy that I had barely enough time to take some great pictures of some interesting content in the art museum. However, I lacked the time to take the second picture that I usually take of the actual plaque, so I didn't know what I was taking pictures of. So I'm sitting there, I have this collection of rather interesting and fun and intricate pictures of different things throughout the entire museum, but I didn't have any provenience. I didn't have anything referencing them. I couldn't tell you who made anything. Enter the Philadelphia Art Museum website, which I don't know if this is a common occurrence among art museums or whatnot, but you can actually browse the collection that's currently there. And by browse them, I mean you can actually like do a search for tags and things like that. So I took a picture of a Hindu god, and I was unaware of what the god's name was. I had been misspelling it. I wasn't really sure. So I did a search for elephant, because the god has an elephant's head. So I was like, okay, let's see what this brings up. And as luck would have it, there's only three pieces that are currently on display that actually use the tag elephant. So I clicked on the one that it was that it looked like, and it turns out that not only was the statue that I had taken a picture of, you know, on exhibit, but they gave me a bunch of other supporting information on it. And they also allowed you to actually tag it yourself if you felt like it. I haven't had a chance to actually go in and do that, but you can add to the lexicon that's already there. You can actually you know, take it one step further and say, okay, not only does the tag elephant and Hindu and statue and carving also associate with that, but you can also say, and like the actual god's name is Ganesha, I believe. So you know, that name is actually tagged on there, but you know, it doesn't have like elephant statue, or it doesn't have like a couple other little things that I was thinking of when I was sitting there. And it was kind of cool that you can actually, you know, participate in it. And to go beyond that, but you can actually click on some of the links that they have available on the website and see other pieces that were in the same room. So if you happen to have, you know, like a bunch of really good pictures of something that they really couldn't explain, or you didn't have time to actually look through, you can kind of try and piece together your journey throughout the art museum photographically through their fun little interactive map. So I just wanted to kind of pass it along because I thought it was really awesome. And then at the very end of the article, there's the obligatory picture of my son standing at the top of the Philadelphia Art Museum steps, a la Rocky, with his fist in the air. So I just thought I had to put that out there. You know, it's a little bit of a Philadelphia culture kind of overflowing at the end of the article, so I thought it was kind of fun and cool, and hopefully you enjoyed it. All right, we're going to head right on into the Geek Cruft section here at the Caffeination Podcast. Then we have a decent amount of stuff in this section, I would say, today, and then we're going to move right on into the consumable and caffeinated bits, then head you out on your way, kind of the roadmap for the rest of your journey here with us. Up first, we're going to talk a little bit about the power of the sun. Behold the awesome power of the sun. A fire caution, however. There's a system in which mirrors can be remotely controlled to take a pretty much an open field. So if you imagine, if you will, a single family dwelling with a rather sunlit and open area. It's a very cold area wherever this house is, and throughout the garden you actually have little stationed mirrors. I think they have like 10 or 12 mirrors, whatever it is, and they're computer controlled, that allow you to focus the mirrors, that would actually focus the energy of the sun to actually warm the house up by redirecting sunlight that would otherwise fall in the grass or something like that. This is a really great and cool and innovative idea. However, they have a caution there that said, you know, you do have to be to not only watch out doing this, because you can significantly raise the temperature in each room, because you can actually pinpoint where the energy is focused. So if everybody's going to be in the living room and you want it to be a nice, warm, and comfortable environment, you can actually have a couple of the mirrors focus on the living room so that, you know, it's a nice, warm, comfortable environment. But they also kind of caution, first of all, you probably want to lock down the controls for this little puppy. And second of all, if you focus too much energy in any one area, magnifying glass style, then you can, of course, set your house on fire. That's kind of scary. I don't know how easy it would be to do, but I would like to see a practice demonstration, I guess. I'd like to see them really actually try and mess us something up with that. I don't know if it's like a Ghostbusters thing where you can't cross the streams, you have to do it just so kind of way where everything has to focus down to like a pinpoint in order to start the fire. Or if you could just, you know, spontaneously have a room combust by having, you know, like 12 little laser beams of light refocused from the sun. So thought it was interesting. Thought it was a really innovative way to kind of tackle the problem of heating and cooling. Because more often than not, when you look at a lot of the different articles that are out there for ecology-minded things, they really deal with human comfort. They really deal with, you know, either heating things efficiently or cooling things efficiently. Because, like it or not, you know, that's one of the most energy-intensive tasks that we go about doing, that and growing food. So it's going to be growing and disposing of food. The entire food cycle is pretty much up there too. But the little redirected mirror thing actually does speak to a very specific population of people who live in sunny but cold areas, and there are plenty of those places out there. So it'd be interesting to see if this actually can take root. Moving right along, what was once a design concept is now eking into reality. We've had a lot of different things coming up from Yanko Design and a couple other places, where, you know, they're showing you like the under-the-counter composting situations. We're saying, oh yeah, you know, you just put your trash in here and bada-bing, bada-boom, you get the compost out a little bit later. Well, this is the first time that I've ever actually seen a real product offered. Now, this is only offered in Japan at this point, and it is for the rather princely sum, some would say, of $881. It's also very kind of small form factor here. I mean, it looks just like a slightly oversized trash can. You can put just a certain tiny amount of food in there, and then it actually gives you 1/7 of a cubic meter of soil out the other end. But here's the funny thing is, it turns everything into fertilizer in just under a few hours. This isn't like a couple days. This isn't anything like that. This is uses a platinum palladium catalyst to break down the garbage and features settings to create wetter or drier compost. So this is really like high tech. This is like top of the shelf kind of stuff. And it's interesting because first of all, that the price point that they're kind of aiming at is really kind of over and above what most people would be willing to do. The second thing is that it's really, I would say, like the opening salvo in the under the under the counter compost wars. I gotta say that I could see this in the future being a very common occurrence. This could be, you know, a way to dispose of your organic trash where, you know, you end up throwing soil out if you have to. Like, I mean, if you don't have a garden, if you live in an apartment or something like that, what are you gonna do with soil? But I mean, if you throw soil out, the only thing you're doing is fertilizing the dump when everything gets to the end of the line. So it would be an interesting little switch up there. I really want to know what the end game would be for this kind of situation. I mean, ideally everybody would just end up using the soil for, you know, their garden or whatever in their backyard, but in the middle of winter, what are you going to use the soil for? House plants? I mean, there's a whole bunch of other different things that really kind of need to be understood and kind of ironed out here. So the opening salvo comes in at $881. A little bit pricey for my blood, but you know, hey, I'm going to be interested to see where the technology goes, got to tell you. All right, up next from ecofriend.org, there's an autonomous robotic fish that monitors water pollution in the Thames. This, we've talked about it before, but this is the first time I've actually seen pictures of it. It's really a freaky fish. This thing looks like it's wearing sunglasses, which is why there's the really bad reference to the Sunglasses at Night by Rick Astley. It also looks like somebody actually, like, bedazzled a fish. There's no other way to say it. It's really kind of, when you say robotic fish and you just extrapolate every little section of that phrase to, you know, okay, fish, you know, you kind of loosen what you would consider a fish. Then you say robotic. Loosen what you would consider to be robotic. And then you add, like, this weird kind of bling element to it that it's really hard to kind of pin down exactly what's wrong with this fish, but it's more of a cartoon than anything else. I love the idea behind it. There's a heavy dose of artificial intelligence that actually goes into this thing. It communicates with a Wi-Fi router on a boat or some other thing. They could actually have like way stations, and it's able to actually follow clouds of pollutants and monitor different water temperature direction, stuff like that. So it's going to be able to navigate all on its own. It has GPS and a whole other host of other interesting things. There's a control center where it can also recharge their batteries, so when the eventual robot uprising happens, we're not going to even be safe in the water. This has kind of been understood for a little while, you know, when you see the robots that can, you know, swim and stuff like that, but this is actually like a pseudo fish here, so you're not even going to be able to understand what really is the friend or foe here. So it's going to be kind of fun to see what exactly happens with that. And then moving right along in the same kind of vein from over at Engadget.com, a new material could make robot muscles better, faster, and stronger. Now, this is something I was unaware that we really needed to do. I mean, they're already, you know, orders of magnitude stronger than us to begin with. But there's this new thing called nanotubes that they're actually, you know, once they're electrified, they can actually 100 times the strength of steel. These things are actually capable of being operated from a huge, huge range of temperatures. We're talking from minus 196 degrees Celsius to a plus side of 1,538 degrees Celsius. This is a massive, massive range. I mean, that's above and beyond anything that you'd really expect any kind of technology to perform in, and it kind of leads you to believe that these things are probably going to end up being used for more space exploration. Well, I don't really know exactly how cold space is. I'm pretty sure that, you know, minus 196 degrees Celsius is a good start on the way to actually being able to survive the rigors of space. And the heat of re-entry, you know, who knows if that's 1500 degrees Celsius or not, but it's really going to be interesting to see exactly what they do with this. I mean, nanotubes and nano everything is pretty much the next wave of technology. It's taking the ultra small and actually, you know, reorganizing things in such a fashion that they actually become more than they currently already are. I mean, all right, now taking the very serious and the very mundane elements of the robot life that are out there. And we're going to kind of break it back down to basics here at the Caffeination. How about a Super Nintoaster? Might burn your cartridges, but I got to tell you, it's been burning up my inbox. I've gotten about five or six different requests to talk about this, and I really love it. Somebody managed to kind of cram a Super Nintendo and a regular old NES into a toaster body. So it's great. I don't think I could have come up with a better slot loading game system than a toaster. I just think it's a great idea. And I don't know if the actual slot mechanism on the side that actually allows you to push the bread down or pull it up actually works. I mean, there's no real interesting thing about that. So I gotta kind of just take it at face value and think that it would be a really awesome console to own and pass it along to you out there, because I thought it was kind of funny to talk about it. All right, up next, we have an interesting little article talking a little bit about biking. Everybody's talking about ecology. People are all trying to find different ways to save the environment. One of the biggest things that people are doing is trying to ride their bike to work, and that's created a whole host of other problems. I mean, the whole share the road thing, where you have to actually try and make lanes on the actual roads that already exist so that bikes can have, you know, a right of way. They can have a little bit of throughway and be able to navigate safely from point A to point B just as easily as cars do, except bikes have a whole set of different rules and regulations that apply to them. And before we get on into that, I did have to tell you, I'm sorry if the show's actually a little bit choppy, but I've been jumping out of my skin like three or four times during the recording of today's show, because I didn't realize it, but I keep hearing this like really deep scratching in the walls or in the layer around me. Now I record at night, and I'm not I'm not an otherwise nervous fellow, but you know, when you hear really loud scratching in the walls and you're pretty much alone down in your own little layer, you kind of start to wonder exactly what it is. It turns out it's the turtle. We have a turtle running around down here, and it was kind of just sort of stuck up against the wall and kind of scratching ever so slightly every once in a while to try and find its way out. And it kind of confused the matters even further, because it had a little bell from one of the cat toys trailing behind it. So there was a tiny little tinkle and then a big loud scratch here and there, and it was kind of just throwing me off. So if there's a couple points in time during the show where I kind of just trail off strangely and then pick right back up, that's what happened. Just wanted to kind of let the cat out of the bag, so to speak, on that one. But back to this little interesting story that we have here. This is talking about how bikes actually use the road. Now, there's an interesting little discussion on how, you know, if bike lanes are actually useful, do cars even pay attention to them? And I don't really think that this would be a great idea. There's a way that you can actually attach a fun little thing to your bike so that it actually causes the bike to leave a trail of chalk behind it. Well, I know a lot of people out there who would think, first of all, that this would be kind of disgusting after a certain little bit of time. If everybody had these on their bikes, then, you know, the entire street could be littered with tiny little lines. I think it's a pretty cool idea. I think it would make the streets a little bit more interesting. But I think from a traffic planning perspective, I also think it would give a little bit more information on how people actually use the road. So I'm passing the article along to you so that you can actually, you know, take a look at it and see exactly what you think. The old style of how this was actually working was more cars on the road were perceived dangers from bikers, and they're saying that the new way would actually increase visibility of bikes, because it's not a reflector, it's not something that the car has to see, but it's like a subconscious thing that the car can see that, hey, this is a heavily traveled area by bikes, maybe I should slow down. I don't really know if that would happen, but I just wanted to pass it along nonetheless, because it's an interesting little idea. Even if it might not actually work the right way, we'll see exactly where it'll go. Now, we've talked about the fine art here at the beginning of the show. We talked about, you know, going into the Philadelphia Museum of Art and finding all the different little pieces of art there. Now, this kind of thing probably won't make it into the Museum of Art, which I kind of lament to a certain extent, but small Lego mosaics is a really kind of interesting thing. It's people who took bits of Legos and actually made 8-bit art out of it. So they have an old Yoshi, they have a a toad. They have a couple other things that are up there. So I just wanted to kind of pass it along to you because I thought it was really kind of fun. They have Pac-Man, Dig Dug, Zelda, Mario, and Pengo beyond this little article. This is from over at BrickPlayer.com. A fun little site, I got to tell you. I hadn't seen it before, and I'm traveling around there, and there's going to be a lot of stories coming out of there. I'm going to tell you that. All right, next little thing here is you are not safe no matter where you are. Keystroke sniffing via laser. Now, if you don't know what keystroke sniffing is, it's basically a way to tell what you were typing on your computer. Now, there's little programs that they can log in called keyloggers that can actually sit in between the keyboard and the computer. So there's nothing loaded onto the computer yourself. It's a tiny little device that sits as a pass-through in between the two devices. There's also keylogger programs that can click, or they can track every mouse click and every keystroke that you do that way. This is a completely different way. It's a way to use a laser to bounce off the back of the laptop that somebody's typing on. And then through the changes in vibration of the laptop, as you type on it, they can actually find a way to tell which keys are being struck. This is much in the same way, that scientists can figure out where planets are based on the wobble in the gravitational field. Through trial and error, they can actually kind of pick out where in the keyboard you would have hit to cause that specific vibration. I think this is an unbelievable article. I think it's really kind of crazy, but I don't know how dangerous it really is. I mean, this just basically goes to say, you know, if you were in public, consider anything that you do much more public than if you were in private. If you were on a computer, consider anything that you do on the computer, no matter how safe, no matter how secure you are. Once it is digital, there's no going back from there. There's always a point of entry that you haven't thought of. So I just really kind of thought this was fantastic and awesome and all at the same point in time, so I wanted to pass it along to you. All right, interesting little story from over at ABC News. Now, I'm not going to get too far into this, but there's a story they ran this morning that's kind of sparked a lot of discussion, a lot of conversation beyond this. It's a surgeon who is actually working on a patient who was awake during brain surgery, which in and of itself is an unbelievable occurrence. I mean, this person's giving feedback because they're working on the language center. And then to take it one step further, the surgical team was actually tweeting, using Twitter, of course, during the surgery. Now, this isn't like the surgeon, you know, dropping the scalpel and saying, hey, you know, what am I doing? Hey, I'm operating on this dude's brain. No, it's more along the lines of an educational tool where people are kind of engaged in the conversation. There's medical students, there's people who are laymen on the one end, and, you know, conversing with the doctors in real time so that the medical students specifically can find out why certain decisions were made. It was an up-to-date, and, you know, like, this happened because of this. They're giving up-to-date things on how they had, you know, okay, you know, so I went in through this area, we already opened the patient's brain up, you know, we're touching this, we're trying to find this out. And it's a really great teaching tool because they can see how things develop throughout the surgery. And then they actually took a video of the surgery. All of this is with the patient's consent, of course. So that makes the patient awesome, I gotta tell you. And then they actually took a video of the surgery and put it up on YouTube. So I'm actually giving you a link to over to the ABC News article so that you can see the same package I saw earlier today. And I was actually talking with on Twitter with Jeff Pulver, one of the absolute really brilliant minds of social media. And we both kind of came to the realization that, or, you know, I don't know if he came to the realization, I rather came to the realization that Twitter is probably one of the best tools out there for one very simple reason. They kept everything, when they were designing it, simple. It has a very, very simple set of skills that are needed to master it, first of all. And then it has a very, very simple set of things that it is capable of doing. And then people add the value in after the fact. You know, it's not like this wonderful doodad or widget that has 15 different features or anything like that. It's a very open-ended, very simplistic system that allows people to build value into it. So it's a very useful tool. So it's going to be interesting to see exactly where Twitter can go now that it's already been in the operating room. And then the last little thing we have up for you here, just for fun, Lost in Translation, Garfield. This is a blog where they repost Garfield comic strips, except that these comic strips have been translated twice. No, they're not in their original Klingon, but the comic strip is taken out of English, which it's originally in, translated into Japanese, and then from Japanese translated back into English. So to show you how much information is actually lost in the round trip, they give you kind of an existential, strange haiku, bad grammar version of the original strip. And it's really off the wall. And you gotta wonder if somebody who's reading the strip in Japanese, if they're getting the same kind of jokes that we would get in the original English. So I really think it's kind of fun, so just passing that along because I thought it would be awesome to share. Alright, moving right along to the consumable and caffeinated bits, just a little brief little commercial like we do every time here at the Caffeination Podcast. If you are listening at the stream over at any of the fine areas that you can stream things online, then this episode is located along with all of its little friends over at www.caffeination.com. That is caffeination.com, and this is the rest of the episode we're coming up right here. March, I think we've talked about it before, but March is actually Worldwide Caffeine Appreciation Month in 2009, so you know, kudos to that. We have had a lot of really interesting and fun stories talking about the caffeination Scotch Irish coffee, the thing that I actually wrote about for the last show, released on St. Patrick's Day. I actually did a little bit of a taste test with some of my buddies who came over on Saturday night, and it received a resounding success from everybody. So I'm curious to see if anybody else has tried it yet or what you think of the recipe. We're still working on tweaking a couple things, so I'll let you know if we change anything. All right, but back to the Caffeine Appreciation Month. There's a great little article from over at needcoffee.com with a bunch of history behind how it was actually declared Caffeine Appreciation Month, and I thought it was fun to see that. And they actually have a really kind of scary picture there. It's 100% purity, white crystalline, full caffeine, net weight 1 ounce. This is like, you know, pure caffeine. I didn't even know that you can actually get the, like, a pure chemical compound of caffeine, so it was kind of fun. Moving right along, they actually have one of the ways that you can actually stay optimally caffeinated. This is a great little article that it was actually linked off Need Coffee. It's from over at scienceblogs.com, where they give you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rules to how to stay optimally caffeinated. The first rule, just going to give you the rundown. If you want the details, you can head on over. Is consume small, frequent amounts. They're saying, you know, caffeine's great for a nice big jolt, but you need to kind of break it down and do small, consistent doses throughout the day. Number two is you play your cognitive strengths while wired. So if you're naturally somebody who works well doing certain things, then hey, you know what? These are the things that get better. It doesn't cover up for areas that you're not good in, but it makes the things that you are good in that much better. Number three is play to caffeine's strengths. There are certain things that caffeine can't do. Like, you can't have massive doses of it, like 600 milligrams, and then expect to operate at high efficiency. So they're saying grapefruit juice might actually keep caffeine levels in the bloodstream higher for longer. I personally have found grapefruit juice a great way to kind of knock down the caffeine dependency, because for me it seems to reduce the barrier in between, everybody gets to that point where you kind of see, okay, this is the fourth cup in the morning, I'm really not feeling anything. I've found increasing the amount of citric acid in my diet at that point, while I'm decreasing the coffee, has a tendency to kind of break the dependency down a little bit, to where, you know, I call those down cycles, where I'm drinking more citric acid and drinking less coffee. I'm currently in one right now where it kind of breaks you back down. So otherwise, I'd probably be up to like 6 pots a day at this point. I think the most I ever was up to was like a pot and a half, and those are like really hard and heavy coding sessions and stuff like that. But you know, I find if you're starting to, you really kind of lose the edge on that buzz in the morning, you might want to start upping the citric acid. Number four, know when to stop and when to start again. That's all about, you know, knowing how your body reacts to certain things. You have to know, okay, I'm getting a little bit hyper right now, you might want to back off and stuff like that. And number five is finding a good source of caffeine. Now, they're saying beyond coffee, there's also things like caffeinated soap, candy, and, of course, chocolate. They're saying for the optimal dose, you want something that doesn't have a ton of coffee, or rather a ton of caffeine. So coffee is actually not what they would consider optimal, because you would have to drink like a third of a cup to actually get the optimal dosage. Well, I'm perfectly fine just drilling the regular cup of coffee and then kind of slowly sipping it throughout the morning, but I really have never tried to do what they're actually talking about, you know, really kind of manage the caffeine levels down to a tiny little amount. All right, moving right along yet again, froth drinks, but not really quite. from over at Seven Gadgets again. We have an interesting little article about a tiny little chef guy with a little whirly gig on the top. This is a way to froth milk and everything like that through agitation of the actual substance. Now, this is one way to froth it, but it doesn't really give you, like, you wouldn't be able to do a cappuccino with this because it doesn't heat the milk at the same time. And yeah, you could kind of microwave it and do it this way, and it's a less expensive version of a bunch of the other things that are out there. I mean, if you have an espresso machine that has the frother on it, that's the way to go. This is kind of more of a way to make milkshakes than a way to make, like, a good coffee. So I just want to kind of pass it along because I thought it was interesting, but at the same point in time, it might not really produce the same kind of things that you're looking for. Alright, necessity is the mother of invention. Now, if you brew beer, like some of the people that I know do, then you might be in the market for a beer, brew fridge thermostat. And, you can follow the little guide that they have over at Hackaday.com on creating your very own, from a circuit board. I mean, they actually have the guides on how to etch your own board, which I've never even done. I mean, it's been a while since I've really done, like, hardcore tiny little, electronics, but this is a really simple follow your own little guide on how to create your own brew fridge thermostat. So I wanted to just pass it along, and also kind of to point out that the discussion below with a lot of the Hackaday articles is worth more than the actual article half the time, because you see people discussing, you know, the pros and cons of the ways that the problems were actually attacked. So these people are knowledgeable in the realms of electronics. They're hobbyists that are very, very good. So if you're going to try any of these projects, I would heartily suggest that you actually kind of give a rundown of the comments beforehand to see if there's anything you might run into. Like, somebody might say, you know what, I tried using that particular part, it really didn't work well, why don't you try using this? Or, you know what, that's a great idea, but, you know, couldn't you add an LED in there as an indicator? Or any one of number of other things. So I just wanted to make sure that I pointed out that not only am I linking to the article itself, but I'm actually linking to the dialogue and the supporting information below it as well. All right, moving right along. The Force is Strong with Beer2D2. This one's a great article, the Totally Cool Link of the Day from Norbert Davis over at the TotallyCoolTech.com podcast. He sent in a great article from over at D-Vice where somebody actually turned the Heineken keg can into a version, derivation, if you will, of R2D2. I love this idea, but every time I see the Heineken keg can, I kind of really lament the fact that they have a proprietary tap. You know, you can't, you know, put any other kind of mini little beer tap into a machine that's designed for them. We were actually walking through Target today, and they have all these tiny little, you know, mini keg refrigerators. I was like, oh, you know, that'd be really cool, except I'm not a real big fan of Heineken, so it would be worthless to me because the only thing that those things can work with, I mean, these are like, you know, $120 fridges that are designed to have, like, you know, like a regular fridge on the bottom and then this slot that you would load this little thing in there. So if they change anything with the design of this keg, you are pretty much up a creek without a paddle. There's nothing you can do at that point. So if it was a little bit more of an open standard there, I might consider investing in that down the road, but not anytime soon. And then to end the show on a real good note, to end the show on a really kind of a little bit of a warm fuzzy, I just wanted to kind of direct you over to the chockfullofnuts.com website, because they have a great link. What was once just a movie is now kind of a real thing. In The Bucket List, where Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman are actually play two terminally ill cancer patients, they're both buried in tins of Chock Full of Nuts coffee. I love Chock Full of Nuts coffee, which is really kind of funny, because when you consider all the other coffees and things that I try and review here on the podcast, out of all of the store brand coffees, out of all of the stuff like that, I will routinely, lovingly buy Chock Full of Nuts coffee. I keep all the cans, so if you're using a Chock Full of Nuts coffee can as a as an urn, my garage right now looks like a mausoleum. If you kind of take it in that aspect. I mean, I think I probably have like around 15 to 20 cans of these things. But we're talking 1 pound, 2 pound, any of the different little roasts that they have there, the city, the original, the dark, the New York. I mean, it's really kind of funny. I'll take some funny pictures one day, but I'm going beyond that. Over at the website, they've kind of the the bucket list inspired people to actually attempt to bury themselves inside Chock Full of Nuts coffee cans because they identified with it so much. So this is going beyond the baseball fan who wanted to be buried in like a Phillies urn or something like that. This is people who really kind of identified with what the movie talked about. And, you know, since Chock Full of Nuts is the heavenly coffee according to the jingle, that they kind of wanted to associate with that and be buried in it. So they actually link to a couple of really interesting stories that they have and letters that were written to them, and it's only going to grow from here on out. So I wanted to kind of just highlight that, as I thought it was a really fun and interesting use of the web to kind of spread that story around. Now, who knows where it'll go from here, but you know, that about I think wraps it up here for today's show. We're in a much extended version here today. I kind of babbled on at a couple of different points, so hopefully you're still with us. Some days, I swear, I just can't even stop myself from talking, but I'd like to thank everybody for listening. This has been Caffeination number 320. This is steeped in history and steeped in something else. Who knows on the podcast today. But it's been really kind of fun, and I'm really kind of glad that everybody could enjoy and join in on today's show. I'm not going to waste any more of your time. This has been the Caffeination Podcast. We are lovingly nestled along with all of our other little episodic friends over at www.caffination.com, and we are a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. All the other member shows, including this one, are listed over at techpodcasts.com. So I'd like to thank everybody from the bottom of my heart for listening to this and any of the other episodes you happen to come across. Thanks so much, and stay caffeinated, people.